This is the MyHeart.net podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Philip Johnson in conjunction with VitalEngine.com. Please welcome your host, Dr. Elaine Bouchard, a cardiology specialist of Birmingham, Alabama, at St. Vincent's Medical Center, part of Ascension.
So today our topic for our podcast is PAD, the forgotten disease. And with me, I have a very special guest, you know, to help us on that subject is a very good friend of mine, Dr. Munish Goyal, who's an interventional cardiologist at St. Vincent Hospital in Birmingham, Alabama, and part of Ascension. We're part of the cardiology specialist of Birmingham. And Munish, welcome to MyHeart.net.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for the offer.
Right. So we know that lower extremity peripheral arterial disease, or PAD, is the third leading cause of atherosclerotic vascular morbidity after coronary heart disease and stroke. It is estimated that more than 200 million people worldwide and over 8.5 million Americans over the age of 40 have PAD. Over 80% of patients with PAD are either asymptomatic or have atypical symptoms, but they're still at risk, and they're at risk for increased mortality and marked reduction in quality of life. So with that said, Munish, if you could explain to us a little bit, what is PAD and how does it present?
Thanks for asking me to come on. So, you know, PAD is essentially what I tell patients. It's, you know, everybody knows what coronary disease is. That's, you know, sort of, it's been ingrained in everybody. You know, you get blockages in your heart and you need stents or bypass. And I tell patients that PAD is essentially, you know, coronary disease of the legs. Primarily, you know, we talk about it, any extra cardiac vasculature, whether it's in the arms and, you know, triple A's, thoracic aneurysms, renal disease, but primarily it's, you know, legs where we see most of the disease occur. And it's plaque buildup. It's plaque buildup in the legs that leads to decreased blood flow, similar to what we see in the heart. And, you know, the thing that's interesting is everybody comes into the office with atypical chest pain symptoms, and real or atypical, and they're always worried about their heart. Whenever people have problems in their legs, they think of everything except PAD. And I think that's, you know, sort of what you mentioned, the numbers. You know, there's a large percentage, I would say, you know, a significant percentage of patients with PAD who don't even know they have it, just because they attribute it to some other illness, whether it's, oh, it's my back, oh, it's a muscle, it's my arthritis, or I'm just getting old. And I think it's up to the primary care doctors, up to the nurse practitioners, the cardiologist, to be able to tease out, you know, what someone's leg pain is for you know, from a PAD standpoint.
So Munish, we have many patients that come to the office and they'll say, you know, I have these cramps in my legs. It wakes me up at night, or I have this cramps in the back of both of my legs. And, you know, when I'm walking or my knee's hurting, can you tell us a little bit, what is a classic presentation for claudication?
Yeah, it's discomfort with walking, any type of discomfort, and sometimes people don't like to say pain. So I'll talk about whether it's a fatigue factor or whether somebody has, it feels as though their legs are heavy, you know, almost like, you know, when you're walking on a beach with, you know, in the sand, your legs get tired very easily. And that typically is how a lot of patients present it. Now, some patients do have a classic cramping either in the gluteal region or in the calves. But if you just focus on pain, you're going to miss a lot of the presentations of PAD. And, you know, in fact, I think to me, you know, we have all these fancy tests that we'll talk about in a little bit about diagnosing PAD, but most of PAD is going to be found with the history and the physical. I mean, I think to me that leads to everything else. And if you have a good history and a good physical, you can almost guarantee that the patients are going to have PAD. Now, the test will help define, you know, the level of the disease, but you can at least know or be certain that this patient likely has disease, and you can start them on medicine therapy prior to any interventions.
So it's due to a blockage. And I guess if you could explain to our patient, depending on at what level that blockage is, you're going to feel certain symptoms, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, typically, you know, we tell patients wherever your level of blockage is, the immediate muscle group below that is where you're going to have discomfort. So if you have blockages in the hip arteries or the iliac vessels, you're going to have gluteal pain. If you have blockages in the thigh, you know, sort of in the groin and in the thighs, you're typically going to have one muscle group below that, which is calf pain. If you have significant blockages in the calves, you can have calf pain, but more often than not, those patients are going to have a lot of rest pain where you're just hurting at rest, or you have a lot of non-healing ulcers, you know, which diabetics unfortunately tend to get a fair amount of, which can lead to amputations. So you kind of go one muscle group below the level of blockage to kind of give you symptoms. But either way, the classic is going to be with some level of exertion, unless you have extreme, extreme disease everywhere, some level of exertion is going to cause a reproduction of the symptoms.
So about 15% of the patient would present with claudication that we described, and of course, according to the level of blockage. And then we have a small number of patients, but very, very important group, that 1% to 2% that would come in with an ulcer on their legs, or their, yeah, their foot, you know, is cold, and they're complaining like that one foot is cold all the time, that critical limb ischemia. Very, very important group to be able to recognize. So who gets PAD? You know, what are the risk factors that can bring about those symptoms of blocked arteries of your lower extremity?
You know, the sort of the similar kind of things that we see with coronary disease. Family history, not as much. It's a risk factor, but not quite as prevalent as what we see with coronary disease. Primarily, it's smokers and diabetics. A lot of these patients will also have high blood pressure and dyslipidemia, but it's primarily the smokers and the diabetics who you can almost count on. They're going to, you know, most of my PAD patients fall underneath one of those categories of a smoker or diabetic. And I think it's important to screen those patients. Those are the ones I think, especially diabetic, you know, I think it's part of the American Diabetic Association is for primary care docs to, you know, examine the feet of the diabetic patients, specifically looking for PAD, because the morbidity of those patients is so high if they do have untreated PAD.
Well, that's great. It's true that about 90% of the patients will have this problem of diabetes and smoking.
Yeah.
It's more prevalent as we get older, isn't it? I mean, when we get in our, you know, 70s, maybe you have like 15, 20% of patients, but you get up to 80 and 85. And
it is
a large percent of the population.
It is. It is a large percentage of the population. And I tell patients, not everybody who has PAD needs an intervention. You know, it's you know, I think it's less so than what we find with coronary disease. To me, I almost treat it as an independent risk factor. So if you have PAD, it kind of portends these are the medications we need to do, because your mortality, even if you take away decreased, you know, quality of life, if you eliminate the risk of amputation, the mortality is still higher. And I think it's just because of the entire inflammatory process that these patients have. And so starting them on antiplatelet therapy, starting them on statin therapy, I think is very important. Just from a mortality standpoint, long-term mortality standpoint for these patients.
Well, so that's great. What happens to these patients? Let's say you have PAD. I mean, what kind of complication, or what are we trying to prevent, you know, with them? What happens to their legs, and what happens to them, you know, as a whole, as a patient?
You know, typically, like I said, it always starts with the history and physical. So everybody who comes in, for me, just because it's an interest of mine, everyone who comes into my office, I take off their shoes and socks. So I'm sitting on my stool and I take off their shoes and socks and I feel their pulses. I'm talking to them, asking them questions, feeling their pulses. And that's not always a reliable exam. Sometimes the pulses are just difficult to feel. But if you feel bounding pulses, which time very well with the radial artery, then it's very unlikely they have significant PAD, especially if their history is, you know, my leg hurts at nighttime and I have to get up in the morning I have to get up at night to walk for my pain to go away. So, you know, identifying these patients with history and physical is important. After that, you know, a lot of it, the first thing for most patients, if you catch them early, is they're going to have a decreased exercise capacity. So they're not going to be able to walk as far. They're not going to be able to do as many things. A lot of times they will have some temperature indiscrepancy, you know, discrepancy between one foot or the other. Ultimately, though, you worry about amputation. Like I said, this is a fairly advanced finding. You rarely, you know, we you know, I've had patients who have come in and the first symptom they have is they have a non-healing ulcer on their foot, but they're able to walk as far as they want, which is a very unusual presentation. Most of these patients have had a progressive sort of claudication history before they start developing ulcers, and then you worry about amputations and stuff in these patients. But once again, that's a lot of times the diffuseness of the disease is going to correlate with heavy smokers and brittle diabetics who don't take care of themselves.
So it looks like from the limb standpoint, it looks like over a 5 to 10 year perspective, about 70 to 80% will just, you know, remain with stable claudication. Maybe another 10 to 20% have worsening of the claudication, and then you'll have those patients that can develop, you know, this critical limb ischemia. That's about 1 or 2%.
Yeah, the CLI, the critical limb ischemia, is very rare. I mean, it's a very unusual presentation. Most of the patients are going to be claudication. Most of it's going to be claudication patients. You know, if you actually, I think if you go a little bit further into their history, I would venture that, you know, that the 80% which they tout of being asymptomatic really aren't asymptomatic. A lot of these patients, if you know, no one wants to hurt. No one's body likes to hurt. So if going from A to B within a 10-minute span hurts, they're going to go A to less than B in 20 minutes. And so they're going to change their level of activity, their speed to accommodate whatever symptoms that they have so that they avoid any discomfort. But that's why I always ask a lot of patients, especially when they walk, you know, if they go, I walk a mile a day, I always ask them, how long does it take you? And, you know, can you go faster? You know, if you go up hills, you know, any type of exertion, increasing exertion can bring on symptoms. And so it's important to sort of identify if someone has a decrement in their exercise capacity and for what reason, beyond just an orthopedic reason.
And I guess one of the messages we want to give today is that's usually a marker of atherosclerosis. And a lot of these patients, you know, will present, you know, over the next, you know, 5 years with a myocardial infarction or even death. And I think this is where it's really important to intervene in this patient. The systemic, you know, MI, stroke, or even mortality is really increasing this patient.
Yeah, I agree. And that's sort of where, you know, using aspirin and statins, once you can identify these patients, even if they're asymptomatic, you know, we're not necessarily treating, we are treating the disease process with aspirin and statins, but more we're treating the overall systemic inflammatory response. You know, more than 50% of patients with PAD are going to have some level of coronary disease as well. And so it's important, you know, to identify those patients, not because you want to put a stent in their leg, but more so because you want to treat their underlying illness, which is that inflammatory, systemic inflammation around their vessels.
Well, that's a very important point because, you know, these patients will have actually more cardiovascular event than actually a circulation problem.
They do. Yeah.
Really important to be aggressive. So Manish, we talked a little bit about how we make a diagnosis, and you were talking about the history and the physical, but we have some non-invasive testing that we use, and particularly the ABI. Can you talk to us a little bit about this? What is that?
Yeah, there's different things we, you know, so the simplest, which anybody can do, you know, doesn't require any equipment beyond a blood pressure machine, is an ABI. And it's this ankle brachial index. So you take a systolic blood pressure in either arm, the higher of the two, and then you take a blood pressure in both legs at the DP or the PT, posterior tibial or the dorsalis pedis artery, and you do a systolic blood pressure, and you do a ratio. And so typically anything greater than a resting, so we have to remember there's a resting and an exercise, but typically a resting greater than 0.9 is considered normal. Anything less than 0.9 is considered abnormal. We have to, there's a caveat though, is, you know, in patients who are, you know, renal disease patients or brittle diabetics, a lot of these patients may have non-compressible vessels. And so you'll actually see super high ABIs, so greater than 1.1, 1.2. And so if you see an ABI greater than 1.2, you suspect, okay, they may have calcified vessels. And so they may have significant disease, but you're not able to compress the distal vessels. So that's the easiest, but it's also the least specific of the diagnoses. So these patients, when you do the ABI in the office, you go, okay, I suspect you have PAD. Then we get a little bit more involved and we can do segmental Dopplers pulse volume recordings where you're looking more segmentally. You're looking at iliac vessels, at SFAs, popliteals, and you're able to measure the flow and look at the flow across these vessels to identify specific regions that need to be addressed or where their PAD could be isolated.
Trying to find out what level is, you know.
Yeah.
So we know that the ABI is pretty sensitive. It's about 95% sensitive.
Yes.
And 99% specific for peripheral vascular disease.
Yeah.
Is there a patient population that we should be screening? I mean, let's say in the office, we see a lot of patients with, you know, coronary artery disease. Let's say out of four patients with coronary artery disease, there's probably three or four patients with peripheral vascular disease. But do we need to screen everybody, or what should be the target population?
You know, I guess it depends on who you see. So, you know, in our practice, I screen everybody just because so many of the patients have been referred to us because of some, you know, for a history of atherosclerotic disease somewhere. So these patients are all at risk. Typically, though, you know, men over the age of 50, women over the age of 55, or those who have a prior history of smoking, diabetics especially. Diabetics, you know, the age threshold goes down significantly. Especially if they're poorly controlled diabetics. But a lot of times it's just simple questions. I mean, you know, so these, you know, in my prior practice, we had three questions we asked patients, everybody that when they came in, you know, do your legs hurt? Do they hurt at nighttime? Do they hurt when you walk? And do you have hair loss? So those questions are able to identify a significant number of patients who otherwise wouldn't have been, on the radar for PAD, but you know, typically it's going to be smokers and diabetics, I think, and then men over 50 and women over 55. From a primary care standpoint, I think they're going to see, you know, if they're going to screen it, they can't screen everybody. You know, the 20-year-olds who come in with sinusitis or not, your utility of screening those patients is very small. So you have to target those with the baseline risk factors.
So let's say your ABI is abnormal. You do a segmental pressure. It looks like it may be aortoiliac level. You can do a duplex, or do you use much of the other non-invasive techniques such as MRA, the magnetic resonance angiography, or do you use CT very much?
I do CT more than I do MR. I've found a lot of false positives with MR. When it comes to the vessels and the legs. And I don't know why. I know, you know, at branch points, it's very difficult for MRI. Renals, it's notoriously high false positives for MR. A lot of patients don't want to stay underneath the tube for an MR as long as it's required. CT gives me beautiful data. You know, patients have normal kidney function. CT is quick and it can give you near, you know, almost 3D reconstruction images of the vessels. So I do that for patients who were not, you know, we're not quite sure of what to expect. Or if I have a strong suspicion that they have a CTO, I'll do a CT because it helps me to guide my access points. If I'm not, you know, quite sure how I'm going to access someone, whether it's through a radial, brachial, or you know, ipsilateral stick, I'll use CT on those patients. But typically, with the symptoms, with the segmental Dopplers, I take patients for angiography if the need comes.
Well, let's talk. And I guess you know, if you find something significant and the patient has you know, quality of life altering symptoms or critical limb ischemia, then you'll take them to the cath lab and
yes,
do a peripheral angiogram. And I guess we'll talk in a little bit. I guess if you take them there, that's because you're, you know, thinking of doing an intervention. You know,
yes. Yeah.
A little bit. Let's talk about treatment, Munish. What can be done for these patients? And we talked about risk factor modification. I mean, obviously, we do that for all of our patients, but, you know, particularly, you know, important for these patients. What do you tell them?
Well, so, you know, you may break it up into symptomatic versus asymptomatic. And so if we've taken, you know, ulcers and critical limb ischemia off the table, because those patients are symptomatic, even if they don't have claudication symptoms, they're symptomatic and need intervention. So if we have a truly asymptomatic patient who has PAD, then to me, it's aspirin and statins, treating the underlying problem, you know, making sure blood pressure is controlled. But the therapy is aspirin and statin for those patients because of the systemic inflammatory response. If patients have symptoms, you know, mild claudication symptoms, still an antiplatelet therapy, aspirin, you can use Plavix. Typically, we don't use DAP therapy for those patients. You can use either aspirin or Plavix. Some of the studies have shown that Plavix may be better for those patients. And then a walking regimen. So, you know, we tell patients, like we do for anything, you know, walk. And typically you start a walking program. And I usually tell them start on flat surfaces, not introducing any hills, no stairs, because that's going to be a level of exertion from a blood flow standpoint that they're not going to be able to accommodate. So you want to walk up to 45 minutes in 5 to 10 minute increments. So walk 5 to 10 minutes. If the legs hurt, slow down, stop, let the discomfort go away. Walk again for 5 to 10 minutes. But you want to walk at a speed where after about 10 minutes, you do produce some level of discomfort. Otherwise, you're not stressing yourself enough and working up to be able to do it for 45 minutes. So that's sort of, you know, the exercise regimen with which I tell patients to do. We'll use celostazole for patients who have more moderate disease. There were two sort of other antiplatelet agents, celostazole and Trentol. Trentol really hasn't been shown to improve symptoms. Celostazole has. The studies have shown that the 50 milligrams of the 100 milligrams BID has been shown to improve symptoms, walking symptoms, walking distance in those patients. Doesn't do anything to modify the disease, but does improve walking distance in these patients. Have to be careful, though, that patients don't have heart failure because it can potentiate congestive heart failure. So, you know, once again, that tie-in between coronary disease, you have to make sure that you've tested them for heart failure before you put them on that. In patients who have more significant disease, you know, we can use Xarelto. So 2.5 milligram BID with aspirin has been shown to be beneficial for those patients. So there's a litany of drugs that we can use, typically more in the antiplatelet therapy agents that have improved the morbidity for these patients. Typically, if we're going to, you know, celostazole is sort of the drug where if we fail celostazole, We do use Xarelto, but at that point, I'm also going to be thinking about an intervention. I'm not, you know, rarely do I have somebody on Xarelto without having defined their anatomy from an invasive standpoint.
Right. Obviously, there's the other difficult things to do, like losing weight, you know, making sure that diabetes is well controlled, and probably the hardest thing is
smoking
cessation.
Yeah.
Like it is so difficult, but it can make such a big difference in these patients.
All right. When I was in my training, the vascular surgeons, they refused to operate on someone if they continued smoking. And it was just mainly because they knew the restenosis rates, the graft failure rates were so high that if you were continually smoking, they wouldn't operate on you for claudication. For limb, for CLI, different, but for claudication, they refused to do it, knowing that, you know, within 3 months, 6 months, the grafts were going to occlude and you would be back to square one. And so it just wasn't worthwhile to take the risk from a patient standpoint to put them through the operation, knowing that they were going to fail in 6 months.
Yeah. It really kind of, it makes a big difference in how the intervention, you know, how long it lasts and the long-term benefit, you know. What about with patients that have hypertension? Does it influence your medical treatment if they have PVD? Do you have any kind of a restriction on beta blockers or use ACE inhibitor much?
I typically don't. You know, I for hypertension, I typically don't use beta blockers anyways, unless there's another reason, tandem reason to use beta blockers for those patients to have heart failure or if you know, some tachycardia. So typically, you know, it's going to be ACE inhibitors. That's sort of my, you know, hypertensive drug of choice. You know, the HOPE trial, the old HOPE trial showed that, you know, these patients did benefit from ACE inhibitors as well. So I think you're protecting yourself. You're helping the patient if you use ACE inhibitors. But I don't know of any specifically, you may know more about this, that of any one antihypertensive class, which is going to benefit these patients more than anything else.
No, not really. But, you know, I want to go back to this walking in your regimen that you describe. I mean, is this something actually, I know that the government has started reimbursing for this. Is it like part of a cardiac rehab or?
It is. So, you know, it's fairly, you know, the data on it's actually been around for a long time. And actually they've shown that a walking regimen is almost equivalent to an intervention, to a percutaneous intervention, if done well, if done properly. And if patients stick with it, I have a lot of patients who they're very intelligent patients and they'll follow through with the plan and they do incredibly well. But the problem is getting your getting insurance to cover it. You know, we've just now gotten insurance to cover heart failure, you know, cardiac rehab for heart failure. So a lot of the commercial insurances don't cover cardiac rehab for PAD, which is sad because it's at, you know, the studies have all shown that, you know, 12 weeks of intense cardiac rehab in these patients is a lot cheaper than the, you know, $15,000 for a stent that these patients get.
I know,
you know, and it blows my mind that we're
bargaining. Has to be supervised, isn't it? I mean, because if you start hurting, I mean, your natural instinct is you're going to stop what you're doing, you know? So they really need to push it because this is how you build the collaterals.
You know? Yeah. Oh, no, you're exactly. You know, I actually, it's funny. I tell patients, because a lot of them, I also, you know, they're elderly patients. You worry about falling and uneasy, you know, sort of uneven steps. So I tell them if they have a long hallway to put two chairs at the end of a long hallway and just tell them to walk back and forth. And when they get tired, sit. So they have some place to sit. And then, you know, I say it's you have 45 minutes to an hour. Don't answer the email. Don't answer the phone. Don't go to the mailbox. Just keep walking back and forth. And I say it's amazing how many of these patients who, if they actually follow through, they'll be able to, you know, they'll go, you know, five laps without stopping. And then by the end of it, they're able to go, you know, almost 30 minutes without stopping. And then, so you can see big changes on these patients, but you're right. The, just like cardiac rehab from post MI or post CABG or for heart failure, the supervised ones are more important because there's some accountability. That's the important thing.
Yeah. It could be at the track or even on the treadmill. I think the study you were referring to, I was looking up the literature. It was called the CLEVER study. And it seems like it was going to be a slam dunk. I mean, these are people with aortic iliac disease. You know, you want to improve inflow to the leg. You put a big, and you compare that to a group of patients that had that very rigorous exercise, you know, training program. And after 6 months, you know, the walking group increased their walking distance and time by 12%. And the group that had a stent increased theirs by 8%.
Yeah.
It even lasted, you know, longer. I mean, longer. 18 months, it was like 10% in the walking group and still 8% in the stent group, which is really phenomenal to me because, and it shows the point that the patients that are walking are building these collaterals. And I don't know if you remember, there's this guy, he used to be at Duke, Brian Annex. He studied these groups and he could see that the ABI, you know, the measure of their segmental pressures and ABI originally was 0.6 and went up to 0.9. Yeah. You know, they're stenting. However, he looked at the MRI of these calves and saw that there was no change at all in the blood flow there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you didn't walk and build up those collaterals, this is how you could explain, you know, the incredible results with MRI.
The problem is it takes work. Yeah. You know, it takes work, and it's more than just the 12 weeks that the class, you know, the chronic rehab class is.
It's 3 to 6 months, you know, it's very significant, the amount of time.
And some patients do it, you know, it's I've been impressed with a few of my patients who were able to sort of do it on their own. I've had a few patients who I've been able to get it paid for, but I'll be honest with you, you know, it's interesting. It will get paid for after I do an intervention. Which goes completely sort of antithesis to what the study shows is you should do it in place of an intervention. So once I do an intervention on these patients, insurance quickly pays for cardiac rehab, and it just doesn't make any sense that we could have prevented that, you know, that $15,000 hospital stay have they just approved the far cheaper rehab?
That's for sure. But it's for sure that if you do need to do an intervention, the exercise training will have an additional long-lasting effect on what you're doing. So let's talk about those endovascular intervention. We mentioned a little bit about the stenting. So we mentioned who was a candidate, mostly someone who has a lot of limiting, you know, claudication. It's altering what they do in life. They can't play golf or they can't do their normal activity. They've failed medical therapy. They're still very symptomatic. They can't do anything. So what is the type of intervention do you do according to where the blockage really is? If you could
kind of
break it down by level.
Yeah. So, you know, if we take aorta iliac disease, you know, one, you know, so, you know, when we think about the heart, we always think about stenting. You know, that sort of the, you know, the old, before we just did plain balloon angioplasty, we saw the high restenosis rates, high acute failure rates in those patients. And so we developed stents for that population. In the legs, it's a little bit different, just primarily because of the forces that the legs are put under, specifically the SFA. So it's not just a compression, you know, it's not a bending. It's not just, you know, the stent is bent. It's you literally have this accordion effect on the vessels. And so it puts a tremendous amount of pressure and force on the artery itself. And so it's going to equate that way to stents. And so if you look at the type of stents that we've done in the SFAs, we have to take that into account. So, you know, but having said that, so for aorta iliac disease, typically from an endovascular standpoint, we primarily stent those. They're not put under a lot of compression forces in the iliac arteries or the distal aorta. So we'll stent those patients, whether it's with just a bare metal stent or whether it's a covered stent, depending on the plaque burden. But typically a balloon expandable stent in those areas, because you get much better radial force with a balloon expandable stent.
In the aorta iliac, I mean, obviously these are big vessel enormous stents. So you got high, like greater than 90% procedural success, and it lasts a long time. I mean, to 10 years? I mean, you have about 70-80%.
You do. You have to have about 80% patency rates in those patients with the stenting. I mean, because, you know, these are 8-9 millimeter vessels. Yeah. And so the restenosis rates on these are very, very low. And so, you know, that's why for balloon angioplasty alone, it's about 60 to 70% patency at 5 years, whereas with stenting, it's 80 to 90%. So most of these patients will stent. Rarely do we do just a plain balloon angioplasty. We'll do it in certain instances. If someone has an abdominal aortic aneurysm, which we have to repair later, we'll try to avoid stenting those patients, just doing a balloon, but that's more of a temporizing thing because we're going to end up putting an endograft in those patients for their aneurysms. Once you get, you know, the no man's zone from a endovascular standpoint is the common femoral. Which is the groin area. You know, it's under a tremendous amount of daily compressive force because we're sitting all the time. And so we never want to stent in that area. Now, there's different zones that you can, you know, we'll find ourselves if we need to. But typically we'll do balloon angioplasty on those lesions, or we send them for surgery for an endarterectomy. So, you know, it's an easy procedure. Patients recover from it very well. You don't do a lot from an endovascular standpoint, the common femoral, also because of the profundus. You don't want to damage the profundus. So we talk about collateral flow. The profundus is the primary vessel which provides collateral flow to the distal SFA. And so when we talk about losing collaterals and possibly for, you know, changing someone from claudication to a critical limb ischemia, it's because we've damaged the profundus and they have no mechanism for collateral flow to the infrapopliteal vessels. In the SFA, you know, typically depending on what the vessel, whether it's soft plaque or calcified plaque, we do some sort of atherectomy or simple balloon angioplasty. Rarely do we put stents in unless we have a significant amount of recoil or if we have a dissection. And even then, even a non-flow limiting dissection, unlike in the coronaries, which we always stent, in the leg, if it's a non-flow limiting dissection, and if the luminal, gain on the vessel is significant enough, we won't stent those. We'll leave those alone. But we do prep the vessels most of them with balloons, typically after an atherectomy. Popliteal is another one of those areas, not quite as worrisome as it would be with the common femoral. But we will intervene on the popliteal more often than not. We'll do endovascular on the popliteal. Mainly, one of the things I always tell patients, and you never want to do an intervention which is going to further hamper potential interventions later on. So I never want to do something which is going to make a further intervention, impossible to do. And so, the popliteal very rarely, from a surgical standpoint. And when I say, further interventions, it's okay, if the endovascular techniques don't work, then it's going to be a surgical bypass. And so, occluded popliteals will work on, because if you're not able to open it up or if it restenosis, these patients are going to require a below the knee popliteal bypass anyways. And so you really haven't hampered the surgeon's ability to treat the patients as well, unless you get too far distally where they have no good targets at the tibioperitoneal trunk or the distal popliteal. So that's one thing to always keep in mind, no matter what intervention you're doing, no matter what level it is. You don't want to do something which is going to compromise any future therapies that these patients can have. But we do, like I said, in SFA is primarily where we see most of the disease process. And so there it's typically some sort of atherectomy, whether it's if it's highly calcified, we'll do a CSI. If it's soft plaque, we'll do a laser or atherectomy with a Silverhawk. Followed by some sort of balloon.
We'll talk about that in a little bit, Manish, but just for our patients, the SFA that you were discussing is the artery inside the thigh, and the popliteal artery is like right behind the knee.
Yes.
It's a very important area because it has to bend, all the time.
Yes.
So don't want to put a stent there. And below the knee, there's really not much we can do, right? Intervention-wise, or is there some kind of a balloon sometimes that you can do to reestablish flow, particularly if you have limb ischemia?
Well, that's actually where we're seeing a lot more innovation is in the below the knee, specifically because, one, we have such a high diabetic population in this country. And so that's going to lead to increased CLI cases. And so we have to identify why we're doing something below the knee. And if it's for someone with pure claudication, typically we don't do it. Typically we're going to leave the below the knee and we're going to just address the suprapopliteal above the knee vessels. Below the knee, if someone's got critical limb ischemia or if they have severe lesions in all three, so if you have very limited flow, you essentially have, a suprapopliteal lesion, above the knee lesion. So there you'll do typically a balloon. You'll use simple balloons. They do have, there's various cutting balloons, regular balloons, drug-coated balloons, which we use less of now, and we'll get into that why, but we use less of that now. So the therapies for going below the knee are ramping up quite a bit these days.
So let's say, Manish, let's take a patient's perspective. You decide that when it's getting really bad, the claudication is getting severe, and you're concerned about them. You bring them to the hospital. What happens to them? If you could kind of describe what happens to the patient, they get to the cath lab, they get sedated. How long things take? Did they go home the same day?
So it's one, you've identified which leg hurts. So I always ask patients which leg hurts the most, just because the nature of the way the catheters work and how the interventions work, we go on the opposite leg. So if the left leg hurts, we access the right leg to take pictures. And so we'll bring them to both groins get shaved, patients get sedation, so they're sleepy, not completely asleep, but sleepy enough where they don't really care much. And then we put a catheter, a small sheath or sort of an IV in the groin of either the right or the left leg. And then we take a catheter that allows us to shoot dye into the arteries. And there we're able to identify the intravascular flow. So we can intraluminal flow. So we can look and see where is the blockages on these patients? Is the blockage the level of the iliac arteries? Are they the level of the SFA or are they level of the below the knee? And then depending on what symptoms they have. So what am I trying to treat for these patients? And one of the things to remember, you don't want to fix everything. That's not the point of peripheral vascular disease. The goal is, why did the patient come in, and treat that underlying problem? So if it's claudication, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be because of iliac disease or SFA disease. And so we'll treat those patients typically with one of the interventions that we mentioned before. And for most of these patients, you know, if we're able to use a closure device where we're able to seal the artery where we went in, they have about a 3 to 4 hour bed rest. They can go home. A lot of times they can go home the same day. They do have to walk around. You want to make sure if there's any groin complications that we witness them in the hospital by, you know, nurses and doctors that are trained to look for that. But most of these patients are allowed to go home the same day. Some patients, like I said, you know, depending on where the blockage is, we access the same groin, but you have to go backwards, or you have to access the feet and go retrograde, or you do what's called a pedal stick to address the blockages. The pedal sticks are typically in patients who have CLI. So those are the patients who you're going to work on blood vessels below the knee for the most part, or they have 100% blockages in their thigh arteries, the SFA, the superficial femoral artery. And so you need to come from below to fix. But most of the patients typically, we go from one groin or the other. We treat the contralateral leg, and I would say probably 75% are able to go home the same day.
Let's talk about those interventions. Of course, you've talked about balloon, and it looks like if the lesion is not too long, just a few centimeters, you can use just a plain old balloon.
Yeah.
Sometimes when the lesion or the blockage is longer, you use these nitinol stents. I guess it's nice with the nitinol, they just kind of, they keep growing to really—
the vessel size, yeah.
Increase the vessel size, which is very nice. Now, how about if you have these very, very long lesions? You know, let's take a case, for example, you have someone that has a blockage of, you know, 20 to 25 centimeters. So it's a very, very long blockage. It looks like you have some options there, but maybe let's discuss those options. Sometimes they can be problematic. So you got this drug-eluting balloon, and you have drug-eluting stents, pretty much. Let's talk about that drug-eluting balloon and some of the problem that we've seen, because, you know, obviously it's the only one available, well, currently on the market, was with paclitaxel, the stents. So what's the problem with these balloons, Munish?
Well, so, you know, they actually worked. I mean, so if you look at their efficacy, they did incredibly well. You know, they were more for more focal lesions. You know, if you look at even the size of the balloons, they were typically less than 120 millimeters. So, you know, 10 to 12 centimeters at that longest lesions. And they prevent, you know, like in the coronaries, they prevent restenosis. The problem is that when they went back and did meta-analysis, they saw that there was a signal for higher mortality. There's still some debate, though. So there's still some ongoing debate on whether or not there's a true mortality or just a signal for mortality. But since that time, it's probably been 2 years now that data came out. The use of the drug-coated balloons has probably gone down 90%. Prior to that, we were using them on everybody, to be honest, just to prevent restenosis because the data on restenosis was so high. We'll use them now in someone who has continually recurrent lesions. If they recurrently, you know, restenose the similar area, same area within a stent, or even at, you know, just at a focal spot in SFA, we will use the drug-coated balloon, but we always, with the caveat, we give them you sign a second waiver with the understanding that there may be a higher mortality with this, but there, you know, it's a very small number that even that meta-analysis found, but it's enough that you're taking someone with a stable symptom, you know, claudication, and you're introducing a potentially higher mortality product. So it's going to be not used very often just for that reason. So typically we've shied away from drug coated balloons at this time. The studies are still ongoing though. So, you know, I think hopefully the data will rule in its favor again.
You know, it looks like the risk to benefit ratio was really, you know, marginal. I mean, they were looking at, they put together about 5 to 7 studies together.
Yeah.
Finding out that, yeah, the target lesion revascularization was much lower.
You know, it
was less than 50%. But there was this increase in mortality and the risk of amputation, which was higher by 50%. So that's, you know, that makes you pause.
It does. And the other thing is Medicare, while they wouldn't come out and say that they're going to put a black box warning on these balloons, they did put a statement out there. And so from a medical legal standpoint, you know, it put everybody at pause because of this. Now, you know, the question on the amputation is, you know, were we using it on patients, even the highest risk patients, right? So, I mean, because that's who you're going to use it on then at the end is these high risk patients. And so it's difficult to know whether or not it was because of patient selection that we were seeing the amputation rates higher than otherwise.
Yeah. But, you know, if we kind of look at the data in the coronary, I mean, you and I have put in plenty of, stents in our life.
Yeah.
Remember, it was always the sirolimus versus paclitaxel.
Paclitaxel.
And somehow there was, sirolimus was always, winning. And there was even some increase in risk of mortality and risk of myocardial infarction with paclitaxel. And if you look at the drugs per se, you have paclitaxel, which is a cytotoxic drug. And, it has, obviously you want to prevent the smooth muscle, proliferation.
But
when you're killing cells, there's a lot of things that can happen and you create more inflammation. It looks like the sirolimus, was better from that aspect. It was, large, safety margin, less inflammation.
It's a static, which is why in the coronaries, now we use, zotarolimus. So, we don't use a paclitaxel in the coronaries. At least in most institutions. I'm sure there's still some, I'm sure, that do just from contract reasons more so than anything else.
Yeah. Well, I think this, and there was also these, I saw some of these peripheral trials were talking about distal embolization, related to these, drug cooler balloons. But obviously we understand that paclitaxel, it's easy to put on the balloon, put inside the artery and it's easy to absorb into the wall. And that is the problem with the Limus, drug. It's a little harder, but they're coming. I mean, as a matter of fact, we have a trial that we're going to be doing together with UAB coming up next year in the coronary arteries, where we're going to be using a drug coated balloon, using sirolimus inside the coronary artery for in-stent restenosis. And also they have a segment where they're going to do the peripheral vascular disease as well. And I really look forward to it. What about the drug-coated stents, Munish? I mean, is it still also paclitaxel that is used in these stents?
It's the only one right now from a drug-coated standpoint is the paclitaxel. We just don't use it. We just aren't using it, I think, outside of a lot of trials right now. The only drug stents that I've used very rarely, below the knee, I'll use a drug eluting stent below the knee and then for popliteal vessels, which is sort of an off label use of it. But I remember when I was in training in early 2000s, we did a study with Dr. Hilligus and showed the patency rates of the drug. This was the old, the J&J, I don't remember the, what was the name of the stent that they had?
So long.
years
ago.
So we were using those stents, below the knee, and the patency rates were very good on those. You're right. We're just the stent world right now is. I think the big focus on the stent world right now is the maintaining compressibility of the stents. Having compressibility of the stents, but maintaining radial strength. That's the problem with these self-expanding stents. And so if you look at a lot of what the stents are doing is they're being able to withstand the accordion effect that we see in the SFA. And I think that's probably where you're going to get, you know, more development right now, is because of that, more so causing restenosis.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think those drug-coated balloons are going to get really good. They're developing some with, you know, sirolimus and for the coronaries as well, peripheral. But there's another area that really interests me because, and I'm a bit jealous that you're working in that area and we don't have that in the coronary so much now, although it's, I think it's coming in the U.S., is this lesion modification. You know, when you have, you know, a lot of calcification, you have a severe calcification of those arteries. I mean, obviously, fluoro can be misleading. We know that when you do CT, you can have a lot of blooming effect and you could overestimate. But there's a lot of studies being done with IVUS or intra-arterial imaging and OCT showing that calcium inside the arteries. But what do we have? What do you have in the cath lab? What do you use to kind of get rid of the calcium? Because obviously it's going to affect a lot on your balloon angioplasty or...
If we suspect there's a lot of calcium, we'll do an IVUS. So if we're concerned, you know, what type of lesion are we talking about? The good thing is in the legs, it's pretty obvious. I mean, even without, you know, just you put them underneath and you can see the vessel outline. And so typically, you know, you're going to see the calcium burden. And so there's a new balloon called the Shockwave, which sort of introduces pulse bursts of energy to help break up the calcium plaque. So that when you do a balloon, and the problem with calcium is when you balloon it, just straight balloon, you create all these intimal tears and dissections, which can then propagate up and down the vessel. So what Shockwave says is that they introduce, you know, low inflation balloons, but they introduce these pulse wave energy, which locally breaks up the calcium, so the vessel is able to expand nicely without causing dissection or distal embolization. We're doing that some. It's expensive right now. So primarily for calcified lesions, we do orbital atherectomy. So CSI or rotor blade, or it's a rotor blade type of device, but it's a diamondback. It's called diamondback, and it's a burr. Essentially, I tell patients, you know, it's literally a burr. We're going in and we're just burring out the calcium.
You're going to feel like you're at the dentist.
Yeah, literally. I mean, it's what it sounds like. And, you know, patients can feel it because it generates a fair amount of heat. So, you know, you have a special, you know, fluid going down it to kind of keep the vessel cool. But it doesn't take away calcium completely because that's not the object. The object is to modify the amount of calcium so that the vessel becomes pliable. And so that way, when you do, because at the end of the day, we don't want to stent if we can help it. I would say we probably stent less than 10% of the time in the SFA, in the thigh arteries. And so if we're able to modify the vessel so that way the vessel wall is more compliant, then I can put a balloon in and with gentle inflation, open up the lesion and restore flow without causing dissection, without causing distal embolization. And so that way you're able to protect the infrapopliteal vessels. We do with some of the devices, you know, you can use the Silverhawk atherectomy, which is literally a cutter which goes in and you can use that for calcified vessels as well, where it cuts away at the plaque. For heavily calcified vessels, it doesn't seem to work as well, but for medium and light calcified vessels, it works. And why I like that for that particular reason is because you can use a filter. So that way, any of the debris will get caught within the filter. With the CSI, theoretically, it spins at such a high frequency that the particulate matter is so small that it's going to get washed away in the microvasculature, and so you're not going to typically a filter is going to be ineffective for those patients. But typically for calcified vessels, it's a CSI, the diamondback orbital atherectomy that we use.
I think that lesion preparation is so important. I mean, it's important also in the coronaries, but you guys do that all the time in the legs, you know, and you have this intravascular lithotripsy. I mean, it's similar to breaking up, you know, stones in the ureter, you know, for the nephrologist. So it looks like if you have a lot of calcium, I guess you have options. Now you have the orbital or rotational atherectomies.
Yeah.
Then you have the intravascular lithotripsy, the Shockwave. You know,
the Shockwave. Yeah,
does it hurt much for the patients? Do they feel that at all? This
The shockwave, they don't. I've not had, like I said, you know, the heavily calcified, the tighter the lesion for the patients with that I use the orbital atherectomy, the CSI, they do sometimes feel that because we typically have to go at higher, you know, scale up the RPMs on those. And so once you get to the highest one, they do, it does generate a fair amount of heat. And so that's why you can only do the runs for a certain amount of time to let the vessel kind of heal in between or cool in between. But for the most part, we just, you know, typically before we go up with the atherectomy device, we'll give them more sedation just so they don't feel anything. But for the most, usually they're asymptomatic during the case. You know, they will feel, it's interesting, they always feel, once we establish flow, the next angiogram, they always hurt. And that's actually a good sign because now we're able to get that dye down into their toes, into their feet, and it makes them hurt because the dye hurts when it gets down to the microvasculature. And so whenever they feel a pain with an angiogram shot, I always feel better. Okay, good. I've established more flow for these patients.
Yeah, that's right. I guess it's a good sign of healing. No pain, no gain.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So let's talk about now, maybe we'll shift gear and talk about this dreaded, you know, CLI or critical limb ischemia, and also the acute limb ischemia. Yeah. Which fortunately we don't see that often, but it's like the heart attack, you know, of the lower extremities, like a STEMI.
So, you know, we'll start with the CLI, the critical limb ischemia. It's literally a non-healing wound. That's its typical presentation. You know, I've had some patients who they'll have distinct temperature differences between, you know, the one leg versus the other, but that usually more is acute. But typically with the critical limb ischemia, it's a non-healing wound or an ulcer that these patients suffer from, and that's when you typically know you're dealing with a multi-vessel or multi-segmental disease, and you're going to need to improve flow in the infrapopliteal vessels, and that's where the importance of understanding the angiosomes and knowing which one of the three main infrapopliteal vessels supply which aspect of the foot, so that way you can maximize the flow there. So, you know, you typically want at least two vessel runoff for patients with critical limb ischemia to be able to heal most wounds. You know, you can get away with a single anterotibial or posterotibial if the wound is just in that respective angiosome, but typically you want at least two vessel runoff in those patients. That's when we get more aggressive with working below the knee on those patients.
Just for our patient, Munish, normally below the knee, we have three blood vessels, three arteries going down. And we're talking about, you know, sometimes we have to get away with just kind of one inline.
Yeah, one inline flow. Yeah. So that's what you want at a minimum, is one inline flow. As long as the vessel that you're talking about, whether it's the dorsalis pedis, the peroneal, or the posterior tibial, typically the two dominant ones are the dorsalis pedis and the posterior tibial. As long as the ulcer or the wound is in the respective angiosome of that inline vessel, then you can get away with one. But typically, if you can provide two, then you've maximized collateral flow. And so, you have arches, just like you do in the radial artery of the arches. You have the arches in the feet. And so if you can provide flow from multiple avenues, these patients are more apt to heal the ulcers. And, you know, the reason we don't always work on the infrapopliteal vessels is that they're very finicky vessels. So when you work on them, they typically restenose or reocclude fairly quickly. But one thing to remember is I always tell patients, we just need 4 to 6 weeks of patency. If we have a wound and we can provide two vessel runoff, you know, if we can maintain that for 4 to 6 weeks, then those wounds are going to heal. You know, yet do we want the vessel to stay open longer? We do. But remember, for these patients, it's not so much claudication that we're concerned about. It's making sure that the wounds heal so we can avoid an amputation.
And we've talked about venous disease before, where you have mostly the ulcer on the inside of the leg.
Yes. Yet,
very importantly, this is an ulcer that is on the outside of the foot.
Outside. Yeah.
of the ankle, you know, and it could be it needs attention. You use wound care as well, Munish?
I do. I do a lot of patients with wound care, you know, so I send them to the wound care clinics. They'll do hyperbaric therapies, but a lot of times it's just the appropriate wound care dressings. You know, they have, I can't even name the you know, the various topical agents that the wound care doctors are able to use now, Granulex and things like that, which kind of help promote the tissue to regenerate, to heal. But it all predicates on making sure you have enough flow. You have to have, you know, blood cells going down there. You know, I had a gentleman recently who had a toe amputation from a non-healing wound, and some claudication symptoms, not a lot, but every time he had to get the bandage changed, it kept bleeding. And I said, that's actually a good thing. You know, it's actually good because you have enough flow. We ended up fixing his infrapopliteal vessels because he was a Brillo diabetic, and we didn't want to have recurrent ulcers that happened and require further amputations. But the fact that, you know, the simple things like that in the history that, you know, my bandage is always bloody is actually very good to hear. The patients don't like it because they're, you know, they're messing up socks and shoes, but it's actually very good to hear because you know that the level of the amputation or the level of where the wound is at least getting blood flow. And so, you know, that's typically what we see with CLI. Acute limb ischemia is a little bit different. That's typically, you've had a lesion, just like in the coronaries, you know, STEMI is a acute thrombus. And so sort of the same thing here is you have an acute thrombus or acute plaque that's broken off. I would say that most of these patients, typically it's in the larger vessels, whether it's in the iliac or the common femoral. And so a lot of these patients, we can provide inline, we can provide some flow from percutaneous approaches, but these patients benefit more from surgical approaches because a lot of times if it's in the iliac or common femoral, I'll create more problems by showering more distally with my tools. Whereas a surgeon can go in, he can put a distal clamp, literally scoop out the clot, and then repair it. Now afterwards, if they have more proximal plaque, which they typically do, then we can go back and fix those endovascularly. But typically acute limb ischemia, it's heparinize these patients because they're usually it's acute thrombus and then get surgery to do a thrombectomy on those patients.
Yeah. Those hurt a lot. I mean, a lot of pain, a lot of cold leg.
Yeah, those are patients
within 6 hours. I mean,
yeah,
we really get a lot of tissue damage.
We had a lady in the hospital who literally on Friday morning we go in there and she says my right leg hurts all of a sudden from her knee down, and we're examining her and literally the right foot marked temperature difference between the right foot and the left foot, and so did Doppler's on her, sent her for an angiography, and sure enough she had occluded her common femoral. And so surgery went in, did a thrombectomy, and she's got a warm foot now. So, you know, these patients, they know the minute that it, you know, from their history, you can tell, you know, the minute that this event happened. So it is not a gradual progression of disease. It's just literally an acute thrombotic event.
And it's mostly a surgical disease. So
yeah,
I guess if we recap, you know, we have those, you know, this critical limb ischemia. I think if you have someone with claudication, if you have someone with peripheral arterial disease, and following them over a period of 5-10 years, about you know, 1-2% will develop have a risk of a critical limb ischemia per limb per year.
Yeah.
So you know we have to watch these patients because
we do.
You know, over a period of 5 years, you know, about maybe just 50% will still have their two legs. 20%, 25% will have had an amputation.
Okay.
And the problem is another 20-25% will have died or have a heart attack just because of the extent of the atherosclerosis.
And one thing to remember is once these patients get amputation, their mortality goes up. And it's not because the disease process is any different. It's because they're inactive. You know, it's sort of that data that, you know, I was reading somewhere that patients over 75 who have a hip fracture, you know, if you have a hip fracture over the age of 75, 50 to 60% of those patients are dead within 12 months. And it's not because there was a complication from the surgery of the hip or any, or, you know, PTE. It's because they're inactive. and that level of inactivity, it kills you. You know, and same thing with these amputation patients. Very few of these patients, you know, are, you know, we think, oh, they'll get a prosthetic leg and they'll be walking around like we see that Olympic guy, you know, running on the track. That's not how it goes. Most of these patients, once they get an amputation, they don't walk anymore. And so there's a high mortality with that inactivity, which we try to avoid.
A tough disease, particularly that involves these small arteries, you know, below the knee, and a lot of diabetics, so it's not easy to get blood flow there. So, you know, there obviously there's a lot of research that's being done. I remember probably 15, 20 years ago, we got involved in a gene therapy trial.
Yeah.
And to try to, you know, kind of get some VEGF, which is growth factor, you know, in those arteries. And it was really kind of, it was funny because we had like a group of patients that got treated and a group of patients, of course, just got placebo. And everybody got better. And actually, after we revealed the result to the patient that got placebo that got better didn't believe that they had placebo. They didn't believe us. So, you know, I guess it's a lot about, you know, the care that you give to the patient. But
yeah,
very little that has worked, you know. And
yeah, it's
therapy. We did some studies even with stem cell, injecting stem cell all over the leg. And, you know, there was really kind of no results at all, no difference.
You know, sort of the, you know, the angiogenesis stuff with from the coronaries to the legs, none of it seemed to have worked. You know, it's, in theory, you would think that, you know, by creating angiogenesis, you get all this collateral flow. There's so much of it we don't know about. It's just not hemodynamically significant. You know, you may see more blood vessels. It's not improving, the end myocardial or end muscular flow, you know, skeletal muscle flow.
Nothing has replaced exercise.
That's right. That's, you know, and that's incredibly important. Yes, that's very true.
Well, listen, Manish, I mean, I really kind of appreciate your time here. I mean, I think this is very helpful for our patients with PAD or peripheral arterial disease. I feel like, as clinicians, we don't look for it enough.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is your field, so you tend to look for it a little more. And, you know, I think you can really improve quality of life on these patients. But there's so much that we can do, you know, particularly encouraging to enroll in exercise training program that has made tremendous differences.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if anything, I would want when in my prior practice, we had a very robust PAD program, and primarily but it was just because, you know, you have to have a champion of it, and you have to, we all get engrossed in our own, you know, day-to-day patient, you know, heart failure or coronary disease, you know, hypertension, whatever it is. And it's just simple things. Like I said, for every patient who comes in, no matter what age, no matter what reason, I take all their shoes off, take their socks off, and feel their pulses as I'm talking to them. And then we just put them back on. And so there's no time lost, you know, from the clinic visit. I'm not 3 hours late in clinic because I'm doing this. It's a natural flow. And just for patients to understand that if their legs hurt, it's important for them to ask their doctor, could I have PAD? And when we did that three questionnaire thing, the intake nurses did it on every single patient and put that on the doctor's desk, it would spawn more inquisitiveness into whether or not patients had PAD versus, you know, venous disease versus just orthopedic issues.
Well, hopefully this podcast will help to increase PAD awareness and, you know, for the doctors to look for it and also for the patients to be more aware of what's going on with their body. And it's so difficult because sometimes it just creeps up on you. You exercise less or you don't go as far because you think you're getting older.
Yeah.
You know, actually, it could be PAD. It could
PAD.
Be back to, back to your normal activity.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. Dr. Manish Goyal, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Elaine.
Good work tomorrow.
Yes, right. Bright and early. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care, Manish.
To learn more from our team of cardiologists, please visit us at myheart.net. You can also follow us on social media by searching myheart.net on Facebook and Twitter. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss our next episode.